Hi everyone, and welcome to the special Meet the Board series featured once a month on Tuning Into the C-Suite podcast. Each week on Wednesdays, Managed Healthcare Executive features C-Suite healthcare professionals whom we speak with about the most important issues in healthcare. In our Meet the Board series, we spotlight a member of MHE's editorial advisory board so our listeners know more about our board members and their roles in healthcare. The Meet the Board series is broadcasted at the end of every month. So be sure when you tune in to listen in and learn a lot.
Well, good morning, everybody. Here we are in the first few days of spring, and it's a lovely day where I am in Philadelphia. My name is Peter Werwine, and I am senior editor at Managed Healthcare Executive. And today I'm speaking with Francois Debrantes, who is on our editorial advisory board. And I've spoken to Francois several times over the years and have read his work. He is an absolute expert on the issue of value-based care and bundle payments and the whole business. So thanks for making time this morning.
Thank you, Peter.
So because this is part of our Meet the Board series, I just would want to begin with a question, just a little bit about your background for those that don't know you, and a little bit what you're doing with Signify Health. So tell us a little bit about yourself.
how long do you have?
2 minutes.
2 minutes, okay. So I'll keep it to the short version. I started working in healthcare really almost by accident, and on the employer side, I got hired by GE to work in corporate healthcare, focusing on a whole set of initiatives to try to drive better engagement of employees and family members in their decision-making process when they access care. And that really created an acute awareness of the disconnect between expectations of individuals when they access care, expectations of providers when they're delivering care, and all of that brought into degrees of conflict by the incentives that individuals have based on their benefit design, the incentives that providers have based on the way they're paid. And that solidified really my trajectory in the industry, trying to focus on how do you untangle some of this mess by focusing on making these incentives less conflicting, more converging, and driving both sides, the demand side and the supply side, towards reasonable decisions and good outcomes.
And now you're at Signify Health. Could you just tell us a little bit about what you do there and a little bit about Signify Health?
Sure. I'm actually continuing that trajectory in a uninterrupted fashion, and I can do that because Signify itself really is focused on both sides of that healthcare equation, the demand side and the supply side, and probably a little bit more on the supply side, where I think all of us believe that's truly where a tremendous amount of work needs to be done. So Signify is, you know, one of the leading healthcare platforms for value-based payments and value-based care in the United States. And we focus on driving a payment reform, working collaboratively with providers and implementing these programs on behalf of employers and payers. And using decades of lessons learned to try to bring the right information at the right time for providers to help them in their decision-making process, and insulating them, I think that's the best terminology, insulating them from the more toxic incentives that are embedded in fee-for-service.
Toxic incentives such as what? Are you thinking of when you say toxic incentives? Well, that's too juicy to leave on the table.
Yeah, it's too juicy to leave behind. And look, I've been convinced of this for several years, and continue to be convinced with every encounter I have with clinicians, and not just clinicians, but leaders in the industry, in hospitals and health systems, which is that, you know, provider organizations and those who work in them are primarily motivated by the desire to care for the patients that come to see them and that they manage. And it's a difficult job because you're dealing with a myriad of health issues and co-occurring health issues. And for a lot of these clinicians and healthcare leaders, when they get up in the morning, they get ready to go to work, the moment they step out of bed, they're faced with these tugs of war, these conflicts between what feels right to do for the patient and what feels good financially and rewarding financially. And they're not always the same. And that's the struggle, right? So the toxicity in fee-for-service is pulling you in a direction that can be different than the direction that you would take based on your inherent professionalism and the motivation to care for the patients. So for example, you'll recommend doing tests even though that you know perfectly well that there's very little evidence of their efficacy. Or in some instances at the margin, you'll recommend that a patient get a procedure done because you justify in your own mind better safe than sorry, but at the end of the day, you know that there's no strong evidence. It's probably not going to harm the patient. And oh, by the way, it's also going to bring revenue into the organization. So that's the issue, right? Which is what should be done for the betterment of the outcomes of the patient isn't necessarily tied to the betterment financially of the organization that delivers the care. And that's that tension, that toxicity, that friction is really what value-based payment and payment reform is all about. It's, you know, I'm not a big believer in the notion that you can constantly, you know, kind of tweak incentives to motivate ideal behavior. It really is a lot more about doing no harm first, kind of taking out the stuff that you know is harmful or potentially harmful and will lead to decisions that go against the inherent professionalism of the clinicians managing patients.
So let's pivot into something that people are beginning to talk about and grapple with, people who think and write and talk about value-based care, which is this new direct contracting model. My understanding is that it's getting started and that it is in some sense a successor to the next generation ACO program, but also something of a departure. So could you just fill us in a little bit on the direct contracting model and whether, how you see it? Is this just another creature in the menagerie of value-based models, or are we seeing something quite different here?
Well, I'll start with the end and then move back upstream. So are we seeing something radically different? No, because, you know, when you peel back the thousand flowers that are supposed to bloom in payment reform, you end up actually with a relatively parsimonious set of options. And then you can have a whole bunch of flavors within those options. And sometimes those flavors end up by being more distracting than anything else. And you can, you know, and I think the healthcare payment and learning action network that was set up as part of the ACA to categorize alternative payment models has done a good job in at least creating some consistency in how you ought to think about alternative payment models and the different types. And at the far edge of those alternative payment models are what are called population-based models. And population-based models are designed to help provide organizations focused on the health of a population. And they're expressed in payment as combinations of global payments. And there can be different flavors in global payments. And so the direct contracting model is one of the more penultimate expressions of that global payment, because it truly is a per beneficiary per month payment to a healthcare organization. And that should cover the majority, not the totality, but close to the totality of all the care for an individual plan member. And this is actually a relatively big departure from all of the models that CMMI, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation has released to date. Because all of the prior models, including the NextGen ACO and the Medicare Shared Savings, and even the Medicare bundle payment program, all still rely on underlying fee-for-service payments. And this is the first time where Medicare has said, look, yes, underlying the transactions, we're still going to require provider organization to submit claims, because asking them to stop a known process for a segment of their patients doesn't make sense. They'll mess it up. We'll all mess it up. So we're still going to rely on that stream of data for information purposes, but not for payment purposes. And that's really the important part. So instead, we are going to give a direct contracting entity, and the direct contracting entity can come in different shapes and forms. We will give that direct contracting entity a monthly per beneficiary payment that will cover an estimated portion of the costs for that beneficiary that is designed to be given by the providers that are part of that direct contracting entity's network. So it is up to that direct contracting entity to contract directly, hence the term direct contract, direct contracting entity to contract directly with physicians, starting with a primary care group. So there's a recognition that at the core, you need primary care, extending out to specialty care facilities and others. And those direct contracts between the DCE, that's the acronym for the direct contracting entity, and the providers in that mini network, can take any shape or form that the two organizations agree the payment ought to be in. So for example, you can create a fixed per member per month for the primary care group. You can create a fixed price episode contracts with specialty practices to manage the cardiology, for example, the cardiac care of beneficiaries. So there's lots of innovation that you can do within the DCE, much like in Medicare Advantage. Medicare Advantage plans have the freedom to do lots of payment innovation with the providers in their network. So this is taking Medicare Advantage, for all intents and purposes, into Medicare fee-for-service, and not requiring necessarily health plans to be the manager of those funds, but allowing for provider organizations to take on that responsibility. However, with that responsibility comes significant risk. And to a certain extent, it is more risk than what happens in the Medicare Shared Savings Program, because you are paid upfront a per beneficiary per month payment. And if during the course of a month, as a healthcare entity, the direct contracting entity, you end up by spending a lot more on beneficiaries than what you have been given, you need to float that difference. It's not as if you're going to make it up in fee-for-service payments, because you're not going to get any fee-for-service payments. So it's a different ballgame. And I do think that from that perspective, moving to what are called Category 4 payment models by the Healthcare Payment and Learning Action Network creates a very different type of payment model than what we've seen to date. And if done right, and this is always this is the $1 billion or $1 trillion question, Peter, because these models live or die based on how well they're implemented. And so depending on how well it's implemented, we'll be able to gauge the relative success of the program.
So a couple of thoughts. One, I just want to deal with a cliche. So the indictment of many of the current models, as you know, here we go, is that they were built on a fee-for-service chassis.
Yep.
So the fact that these direct contracting entities are being paid in a more global payment fashion, what in the old days we called capitation, is the departure here. Do I understand correctly?
It is. It absolutely is. Yes, it is.
But on the other hand, this is the way Medicare Advantage has worked. And I've listened to some discussion where people have sort of shrugged their shoulders and said, well, this just seems like Medicare Advantage to me. This sort of walks like Medicare Advantage and it talks like Medicare Advantage, but the entity is no longer a health plan, but a new thing, a direct contract entity. So I guess that brings me to the question of how is this the same or dissimilar from Medicare Advantage? It's sort of the mechanics of it, for lack of a better term, seem similar.
The mechanics are similar. The difference is that in Medicare Advantage, Medicare contracts with a Medicare managed care organization, and that Medicare managed care organization can continue to pay 100% of the care for the beneficiaries that enroll in that MA plan fee-for-service. And, you know, the chassis of Medicare Advantage plans are fee-for-service claims adjudication chassis. Now, some of them are fairly innovative in the way that they create the reimbursements with the providers in their network, but a lot of them simply continue to pay fee-for-service. So yes, it's like Medicare Advantage in the sense that you're prepaying an entity a fixed amount for a beneficiary. The difference is that you're now relying on a provider organization or, you know, some affiliate of a provider organization to contract with providers, hopefully in a different way. Now it's hopefully, they don't have to, but if they rely 100% on fee-for-service and some discount of fee-for-service to pay the providers in their network, I don't think they're gonna be tremendously successful, because why would those providers accept that deal instead of just being in normal Medicare fee-for-service? And second, they need to then either buy or lease all of these fee-for-service claims adjudication. So what's the point? In other words, again, that's why I go back to the key is going to be in the implementation. And if CMS really focuses the implementation on organizations who have a willingness and who demonstrate that they're willing to be creative in how the payments are done to the providers that participate with the direct contracting entity, then I think we'll learn a lot. If all that happens is the DCEs turn around and pay some discount to fee-for-service rates to the participating provider, we're not gonna learn much, right? We're just not gonna learn much.
And the DCEs have the freedom to make up their own minds. And so in a year's time, we might say, well, this turned out to be no big deal, correct?
Yeah. And yes.
I don't mean to be negative, but it just
No. I mean, this is the reality of all these programs. They're voluntary. And in fact, on that theme, Signify worked with both Levitt Partners and then helped fund work from the Leonard Davis Institute at the University of Pennsylvania towards the end of 2020 and into the early parts of 2021. In an effort to get experts in the field to really rethink and map out reasonable changes to how these payment models are designed and implemented, how they're structured, how to think about them in an overarching framework, because we've had a lot of experimentation in payment models that either have been implemented with significant issues or have led to somewhat ambiguous results. And a lot of that ambiguity and a lot of those design problems are oftentimes linked, and you end up with policymakers and others making judgment calls about the efficacy of models as opposed to really doing what they ought to be doing, which is drawing conclusions on the effectiveness of the implementation and continuously evolving the way in which the models are designed and implemented to get to a point where we truly can answer questions about the efficacy of a model itself. So, and I know we only have a short period of time. I know, Peter, you and I could talk about these issues for a very long time, but I purposely want to use that the statement I just made to pivot to what we can do and what we're doing in the private sector, which is using designs and implementation models that follow as much as possible best practices, because we don't necessarily have the same political and other constraints that CMMI has had to deal with. And when you do that, you actually have better ways of observing the effectiveness of models, the transformation of physician practices, even though a lot of this stuff is still voluntary. I do want to make a plug for healthcare services researchers to spend more time looking at what's being done in the private sector, because I'm seeing a really healthy dose of solid innovation and implementations done with a tremendous amount of forward thinking and rigor without the baggage that you sometimes have in the Medicare models.
Sure, and we only have a few minutes left. I wanted to get a couple of points of clarification on DCEs, and then I want to ask you about some of the private sector models. This program, the performance year, begins next month, correct? And aren't there 50 some DCEs signed up? So the boat here is leaving the pier, correct?
It is. We'll see how many actually float, to stay with the analogy, because there are a lot of DCEs who were candidates to be DCEs. There's still, I believe, some decisions that are left to be made about the adequacy of their patient pools, whether or not they actually have enough recruited beneficiaries on a voluntary basis. It's not fully clear yet whether CMMI is going to allow for the voluntary model to voluntary, meaning those who have gone out and recruited Medicare beneficiaries, as opposed to the attribution model, which ends up by being a little bit more rigorous and less prone to selection bias. So I think there's still a little bit of unknown as to how many boats will actually take off and get into this race, how many beneficiaries they'll have, what is going to be the mode of attribution, et cetera. But yes, the program will be launched at some point over the next couple of months.
Oh, I thought there was an April 1st start date on the performance year, but that's now fuzzy.
That's now fuzzy. Yes.
Okay. And it might be, I've seen a figure of 51 DCEs, but those are applicants, and it might be fewer than that when this thing actually gets underway, correct?
There might be considerably fewer.
Okay. So we only have a few minutes left. Is there some way you can sort of, you talked in sort of abstractions about the innovations and what's going on in sort of apart from CMMI and in the private sector. Could you just sort of speak in concrete terms what you're referring to about the good stuff that's going on and presumably that Signify Health is involved in? Maybe just a concrete example or two.
Yeah, and I'd say that the single biggest continuous thrust that we're seeing in the private sector is constantly, and it harkens back to my early days in the industry of encouraging the demand side plan members to seek out the best care that they can get in their local community at the most reasonable price, what we call, you know, value. And that can happen in the private sector because private sector employers have the ability to do steerage. And steerage can take multiple forms. And what's really exciting is that this combination of member incentives to encourage employees to go seek care from the higher value providers with payment reform that binds those providers in risk contracts is the combination that truly drives value. Because ultimately, and we do this with a number of payers across the country, one directly with a large employer, the state of Connecticut employee plan. And what we're finally seeing is what, you know, I think a lot of us knew could happen if you brought these elements together, which is actual competition for value in healthcare by providers who are willing to take on accountability for the management of patients and willing to compete based on the combination of the quality of the care that they deliver and the price that they're willing to charge for that care. So I think if you had asked me a few years ago, I would have said, yes, theoretically, we're pretty sure this can happen at scale because there's enough micro experiments that have been done that show that it can. And today I can say it absolutely does work. There's no question or doubt it can work because we're seeing it work every day. And now the task is how do you scale this out? How do you bring it to 20 markets across the country so that people start believing because they're seeing it in action as opposed to conceptualizing it and hoping for the best.
And the it in those statements are benefit design that rewards patients to going to high value providers, which is to say they have good quality metrics and their prices are low. And then on the supply side, paying those providers in a competitive way. Is that what you're getting
at? It's in a competitive way. And, you know, back to, it's analogous to the DCE. It's giving them a budget, a global fee for the management of their patients' care, whether it's a combination of chronic conditions or the delivery of a particular treatment or a procedure. But it's a fixed amount. It's paid partially prospectively, partially, you know, in installments, in other words. It doesn't necessarily rely on the underlying fee-for-service payments. And if you have a budget that you're managing to, you've got outcomes that you need to hit, and you're not conflicted internally between doing what's right for the patient and doing the right thing also financially for your organization, it works. And that it's not a complicated recipe, but you do have to bring those two elements together. And when you do, you end up with what we thought and believe we would get, which is competition by providers for value. And I'll just give you one little anecdote to close. In Connecticut, as part of the program, the state has created what they're calling the network of distinction. And the network of distinction is just recognizing those providers for certain aspects of care, the management of certain conditions, the delivery of certain procedures, that they have better quality outcomes and that they're doing it at a reasonable price, you know, average, lower than average price. And in Connecticut, a lot of those providers are now doing TV ads in which they speak about themselves. And at the end of the ad, they're post up their certificate of being in the state of Connecticut's network of distinction. They're proud of it. They should be proud of it. And that's competition for value. So, yes, it's working. It's working well. And as I said, now it's a question of scaling it out in different parts of the country.
So I guess you've come up with the good housekeeping seal of approval, but in the context of value-based care.
The network of distinction, that's what it's about.
Good. Well, thanks so much for the 101 on direct contracting. My understanding of it gets a little bit clearer with every time I hear about it. And also, it's exciting to hear about what Signify Health is doing in Connecticut. And apparently, you're ready to take this show on the road, so to speak.
We're ready.
Thanks for tuning into this week's episode of Tuning Into the C-Suite Podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts and follow Managed Healthcare Executive on Facebook, LinkedIn, and Twitter. For more information on Managed Healthcare Executive, visit our website at www.managedhealthcareexecutive.com.